This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now download as a podcast off our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the leading intellectual influences on the Bush administration, the philosophical idol of the neocons, Leo Strauss. And with me to talk about this is Shadia Drury, professor of philosophy and political science at the University of Regina in Canada. Drury has written two books on the subject, The Political Ideas of Leo Strauss and Leo Strauss and the American Right. Shadia Drury, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Tell me, who was Leo Strauss?
Leo Strauss was a German Jewish emigre who left Germany during the Nazi regime and went to England and eventually landed in Chicago, where he supervised as many as 100 PhDs. And many of his students who have a kind of adoring discipleship type of relationship with him hold important positions, professorial positions all over the United States, but also many of them have gone into government. They went into the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, and now are in the second Bush administration.
Who are some of those folks?
People like Paul Wolfowitz, Abraham Schulsky, William Kristol. These are the prominent ones.
And what accounts for his adoring discipleship there? I mean, and I've taken courses from political philosophers and academics without a cult coming to grow around them. What do you make of that?
Well, partly it's a Germanic phenomenon. People have compared, you know, the Leo Strauss's disciples to the disciples of Stefan George, for example. But partly because American political science, and this is where Leo Strauss was in political science, American political science was so dry and dull, you know, and Strauss was like, you know, this Lazarus who's come back from the dead. I mean, he had seen what happened to Europe. He saw the horrors of Europe. He saw the terrors and errors of Europe, and he was going to teach America not to make the same mistakes.
I mean, there were other academics who fled Germany under Hitler and came to the United States, most famously the Frankfurt School. And I'm talking about Herbert Marcuse and Adorno and Benjamin. And those people who constitute the Frankfurt School. And was he with them for a brief moment and then went on? Because they went in opposite directions, it seems.
Yes, definitely. They provided America with the kind of left wing, the leftist kind of critique of capitalist culture, whereas Strauss was extremely conservative in the sense that he wasn't a traditional conservative, not a Burkean kind of conservative. He was a conservative in a, I call him a postmodern conservative, someone who agrees with Nietzsche that there's no foundations for morality, that God is dead, that life is meaningless. But this kind of nihilism that he agreed with Nietzsche about, he thought was just dreadful for politics. He was sure that the Nazis were nihilists. So he was someone who was bereft of faith but terrified of skepticism. So his solution to the current contemporary nihilism is to withdraw from it and to teach philosophers to keep their nihilism to themselves and to keep it secret, and instead spin myths, lies, illusions, etc., for the hoi polloi or the plebeians.
But the problem of Hitler wasn't the fact that there was a dearth of skepticism. I mean, that seems to be a peculiar response to Hitler, to kind of just give up on reason and liberalism, which, in fact, were enemies of Hitler.
Exactly. I mean, I think this is the trouble, is that Strauss learned the wrong things. I mean, he just did not really learn the lessons of Hitler very well. He had already absorbed too many of the fascistic ideas by the time that he left Germany, he was very much under the spell of the likes of Carl Schmitt and Martin Heidegger, for example. So he was a deeply fascistic thinker, and it was just a bit too late for him to see liberalism in any kind of a positive spin on liberal society whatsoever.
I like the comment, I'm sorry, that you made in your book that he's Nietzsche without his softer side, and Machiavelli only more so, it seems, in your description of him. I also didn't know that William Crystal did his dissertation or college thesis on Machiavelli, which is interesting. William Crystal,
under Harvey Mansfield at Harvard, yeah.
Who was a neoconservative, too.
Neoconservative and a very one of the big Straussians in the academy.
Well, tell me a little bit about his thought, actually, because you talk about some of that is just bizarre to me, the way he interpreted texts, for instance. He placed, according to you, an undue stress on the number of chapters in the book or the very midpoint of a book as demonstrating the essence of the book. You can find it there by counting the number of pages and dividing by two. there has to be more to him than that.
Yeah. Well, I think that this sort of his bizarre kind of approach to interpretations of text was sort of part of his aura and technique, and it was meant to conceal what he was about. And it was sort of meant to sort of confuse people more than anything so that people focused on the wrong things. And myself, I'd never took him much to be an important interpreter of all of the texts that he studied. He studied Plato and Xenophon and Machiavelli and Hobbes. And I've never taken him seriously as an interpreter. I thought that most of the way in which he touched on these texts was that these people like Socrates and Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, they were all really characters in the story he was telling about how we got where we got to, namely, how did we come to what he saw in his own lifetime, the barbarism that we have witnessed, which is namely Hitler and the Nazis. And his answer was, modernity and liberalism are to blame.
So he celebrates the ancients instead.
Well, the ancients, I think this is, again, another obfuscation. He celebrates the ancients, but if you look at his study of Plato, for example, you find that he claims that the spokesman for Plato is not Socrates, as everyone assumes, but it's the sophist. People like Thrasymachus, who believe that truth is power, you know, people who believe that there's no such thing as justice. Justice is the rule of the stronger. These are the people that are telling the truth, people who believe that justice is doing good to friends and evil to enemies. So he completely subverts what the ancients are about.
Yeah. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Shadia Drury, a political philosopher and academic at the University of Regina in Canada, who has done a couple books of study on Leo Strauss, who is the philosophical father of a lot of people in this second Bush administration. What is so agreeable to Paul Wolfowitz or William Crystal about this kind of philosophizing?
Well, there is a lot of truth to it. And one of the truths is that democracy is a dangerous form of government because it lends itself to the possibility. There's always the fear. There's always the possibility. There's always the danger that demagogues will emerge because Hitler emerged within a democratic framework. Of course, he quickly subverted everything democratic about the Weimar Republic and amassed power unto himself and destroyed all opposition, etc., and rule of law. So there is that, and I share with Strauss the idea that democracy is actually contains some very severe dangers, but that a democratic government is only tolerable if it is limited, in my view, by liberal principles. Principles like separation of powers, the rule of law, limitations on executive power, those kinds of things, protection of minority rights, those kinds of things. But Strauss did not have much use for liberalism. I mean, he thought that the best form of government is rule of the wise. But the wise can never rule overtly and openly because no one will take that. So the second best is rule of what he called gentlemen who are guided by and advised by or manipulated by the wise.
You have a great line in your book, Shadia Drury, where you say, George W. Bush, in that regard, may be the perfect gentleman. And what did you mean by that?
Well, Strauss thought that the job of political order is to transform natural men who are sort of wild, savage, selfish, love pleasure, self-regarding, egotistical, into husbands and citizens who believe in God, who love their country, who are willing to die for it. And ultimately, that task was a difficult one. And he thought that the best way to do it is through what he called pious fraud, which is religion. Religion is the best way to do that kind of transformation, and that some men will respond better than others to that kind of transformation. And the men who respond the best are the ones he called gentlemen, and those who really believe in the myths of society, believe in God, believe their country is the best in the world, that believe their country is on the side of justice and truth and goodness, and people like George Bush who believes these things.
Yeah. Who believes God is on our side,
and yes,
he's executing God's every wish.
And all our enemies are on the side of Satan, yeah.
Exactly. And so he has this three-tier kind of typology of people
right.
in society. He has the wise men, the gentlemen, and then everybody else.
Yeah.
Who are just ruled by their unruly appetites.
Yes, but you can get these people who are ruled by their unruly appetites to perform acts of great sacrifices for their country if they think their existence is threatened, if they think that their very, very lives are threatened and they have a common enemy. So it's very important. The concept of the enemy is very important. It's very important to create and invent enemies as much as you can to keep people united. And this is one of the reasons that catastrophe is very important. The more catastrophes there are, the more people will come together, and the more vicious the enemy seems, the more people will feel that they are all for one and one for all, that their very existence depends on their coming together to fight a common enemy.
Mm-hmm. And certainly we see in the Bush administration a peddling of this fear. We had the cataclysm of 9/11, mm-hmm. and Bush has always been saying you're with us or you're against mm-hmm. us, and it's good versus evil. So you can see that playing out, but isn't it a little crude for me to assume that Bush is following the Straussian script, or do you think that's exactly what's been happening, that the people who are disciples of Strauss were just peddling this forward? In a way, it suggests that, you know, Karl Rove or Dick Cheney are Straussians, but I don't believe they're that philosophically minded.
I think that a lot of neoconservatives have not even read Strauss, actually, and that and those who have read him, very few of them understand him. And the important thing is that they share many of his sensibilities about the dangers of liberal democracy, about the importance of religion and politics. And some of them are true believers, and others are sort of cynical who think that's what society needs, and they're willing to peddle these ideas.
And Strauss celebrates that.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing about reading this book. I'm speaking with Shadia Drury, who's written about Leo Strauss, that Leo Strauss celebrates deception, celebrates lying, and pulling things over on people. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to square that with someone who claims to be a liberal Democrat or within the tradition of liberal democracy.
He's not at all within the tradition of liberal democracy. He wants to create something akin to Nietzschean Superman, and he sees the idea is to create myths and illusions, that society needs absolute faith, that people have to believe completely in the rightness of their mission, the complete truth of their mission, otherwise they're not being willing to die for it. He was someone who also loved war, that he thought that somehow that a society that was devoted to sort of pleasure, consumerism, was too much fun, sort of dehumanized us. And like Carl Schmitt, he felt that liberalism tended to turn life into entertainment. And there is some truth to that. But so what? I mean, give me more frivolity, please.
They don't seem to be interested in frivolity. In fact, you say that the Straussians and their followers in the Bush administration have a fascination with the jihadists, with the Islamists, because they seem to respect a tradition that demands of its followers that they give themselves up in war for the greater good of the jihad. Do you see the parallels there between the bin Ladenists and some of these Bush people?
Oh, tremendously. I mean, this is one of the difficulties they're having in Iraq and transforming Iraq into something along the model of American liberal democracy, is now they've had an election. Now those in power is the Iraqi alliance, who is very much influenced by the Ayatollah al-Sistani. And this guy, of course, wants to have an Islamic Republic. Well, the Bush administration has put itself in a very difficult position. They can't exactly reject the idea of an Islamic Republic when they are supporting the Jewish state and when they would like America to be increasingly more and more of a Christian country. So, yeah, there is that similarity. Namely, they believe religion is essential for the harmony and cohesiveness of society. But there's also a kind of admiration for the foe. And this is something that people have not understood, is that while Rumsfeld and company are constantly saying things like that our enemies are a bunch of thugs, dead-enders, criminals, etc., there's also a tremendous envy of them. And the envy is they envy them their absolute faith. They envy them their religiosity. They envy the fact that they are willing to die for their country on the snap second. And you see these kind of crazed guys on TV. They look like they're ready to self-immolate themselves completely on a split second, on a demand. And those are the people that, you know, Bush and company are very, very envious of, because then they compare them to, you know, American soldiers. They're complaining about their stay in Iraq. They're escaping to Canada. They're suffering from post-traumatic syndrome. You know, so they feel that...
They want more jihadists in their ranks. I mean, it's such a perversion, this view that the Bush folks have and Strauss has, according to you, a perversion of what a secular democracy is supposed to be. And yet Bush, the anomaly is that Bush says he wants to be spreading democracy, that he's spreading freedom. And yet you say that there are so many people within the administration who are hostile to freedom as we know it. Maybe they have a different definition of freedom.
I think it's important to distinguish between freedom and democracy. Spreading democracy is one thing and spreading freedom is quite another. We can see the problem in Iraq because when we look at places like Basra, for example, there's less freedom now than under the American occupation than there was under Saddam Hussein. Women are not free to walk down the street in Basra without full hijab if they're without fear for fear of being beaten up. Even men can't wear blue jeans or shave their beards. So freedom and democracy are two different things. Democracy is basically rule of the majority. Freedom is something else. And it's because freedom is really about security of the individuals, freedom of individuals to do as they please, as long as they don't harm others. That's what freedom is. I mean, Bush had this interview with Christianity Today, in which he said that his whole reason for being, that his presidency was this wonderful opportunity to transform America and the world. I mean, any president who says his job is to transform America and the world is really not a conservative. It's a radical.
I mean, it is amazing how grandiose his ambitions are for someone who flies under the flag of conservatism. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a guy who said he wants to remake the world, he wants to rid the world mm-hmm. of evil, and he wants to defeat terrorism mm-hmm. worldwide. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those are monumental tasks. And when he describes those tasks, he most often invokes God as the author of, or assigning, taskmaster, if you will. Talk about this departure from traditional conservatism that this radical conservatism marks.
Well, that's a part of the appeal of my books, is that they appeal to a lot of conservatives, because even though I'm a liberal, I also have sympathies for traditional conservatives or traditional conservatism. I think that every liberal society needs a conservative spirit to moderate the excesses of liberalism and the kind of licentiousness to which liberalism is inclined to. But the neoconservatism has no sobriety, no moderation in it at all. It's quite radical itself. It wants to transform America from a secular society to a religious society, from a liberal society to a conservative society. And it not only wants to transform America, it wants to transform the world and remake the world according to this model. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why Colin Powell called the neoconservatives in the Defense Department, Wolfowitz and a few others, Trotskyists, because mm-hmm. he said they had this revolutionary spirit, mm-hmm. which is just the opposite of Edmund Burke's conservatism.
Well, they were actually Trotskyists in the beginning, before they turned neoconservative.
Some of them, like Irving Kristol, right?
People like Irving Kristol and Howe and Port Horitz, probably. Many of them. In fact, when Irving Kristol, they had a party in Washington, D.C. for his 75th birthday a few years ago. All of the neocons, the who's who of the neocons, were there at the party dressed in their finery. And apparently they were going around calling each other comrade, you know, just to remind themselves of their old days.
They may have been singing the Internationale for all we know.
But there is also another sense in which they're still Trotskyites to this very day. And that is what is peculiar about Trotsky and about Lenin is that that they broke with Marx on a very fundamental idea. Marx thought that the revolution would come from below, from the proletariat, from the poor, from the masses. Whereas Lenin and Trotsky thought, no, we're going to wait forever for these people, those masses, to wake up and see what they have to do. That what the masses need is to be led by a vanguard party. And so Lenin and Trotsky thought of themselves, which they were accurately, a vanguard party for the proletariat. And, the neoconservatives are themselves a vanguard, see that society always needs a vanguard to tell it what to do. The trouble is that the liberal elite that has dominated America, they're very unhappy with that, and they want to replace that liberal elite with themselves.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. I'm pleased to be speaking with Shadia Drury, professor of philosophy and political science at the University of Regina and author of two books on Leo Strauss. There's another comparison between Trotsky and Strauss or the Straussians, and that is on deception and lies. Mm-hmm. Because I remember reading a book in college by Trotsky, I believe called Their Morals and Ours, in which he wrote that it's perfectly okay to lie and cheat and steal mm-hmm. from the bourgeoisie, but just don't do it to the proletariat. Mm-hmm. And the Straussians seem to say, basically, you lie, cheat, and steal and deceive everybody except the wise group that's somehow self-selecting as the whispers into mm-hmm. the gentlemen's ears who are going to rule the country.
Well, I don't want to be too cynical about the Straussians because I think some of them actually have good intentions in the sense that they do believe that their evil that they do or their vices or their deception are intended to be deceptions for that are good for the greater number. They are not just for their own self-interest. I mean, there are some, of course, who interpret it to be just we live by a different rule, but it's definitely the wise live by a different rule that doesn't apply to everybody else.
But even if you put that on it, so they're not lying for their own self-aggrandizement, they're lying for the cause, that too is the kind of the Trotskyist mode.
Oh, definitely. I mean, even Lenin, I mean, he loved to listen to the Appassionata every day, but he would refuse to let himself listen to anything so beautiful. He says, it made you just feel so wonderful. It made you feel like you wanted to go around patting everybody's head instead of breaking their head, which is what you had to do in order to transform the world.
Well, that's the connection between the Puritan ascetic impulse and oppressiveness. And you talk about the asceticism too, in part of these people in power, and that is hostility to freedom from a civil liberties perspective mm-hmm. that they seem to have. And we see that in the connection that Bush makes with the far right, with the Pat Robertsons, mm-hmm. and his hostility to gay rights, his hostility to abortion, and the now setting back the clocks 100 years on creationism, mm-hmm. which is a hostility to enlightenment,
science
and intellectualism.
And intellectual freedom, free inquiry, yeah.
And strange that a philosopher at the University of Chicago would end up being someone who's used in such an anti-intellectual manner, though there is an anti-intellectualism that runs through Strauss here, this elevation of the will, which is Nietzsche again, over other things. Doesn't that strike you?
Yeah. I mean, conservatives have always been anti-intellectuals because they feel that, you know, why should you use your own little rationality instead of depending on the wisdom of the ages. But that was not necessarily Strauss's position. Strauss's position was that reason belongs to the few and free inquiry belongs to the few, and that what liberalism does is sort of throws pearls to swine kind of thing, and that the people aren't fit for the kind of liberty. Only very few are fit for that kind of intellectual freedom. Besides, freedom to inquire ultimately leads to nihilism and to atheism and to realizing that there's no foundations for morality and that there's no God and no meaning to life, and that can only be socially and politically disastrous in his view.
Yeah. Now, even if he himself was an atheist.
Yeah.
And so how do they exempt themselves from some of these things? Is that just something innate?
Oh, well, you know, the few are always capable of living in the face of the abyss.
How do you combat, how should we who are liberals or progressives or disciples of the Enlightenment combat these kinds of ideas?
Well, it's very, very difficult, especially in a Christian culture, because the Christian culture meshes with this kind of idea, because the Christian culture is a culture that says to us that human beings are too wicked to be free. And because of the emphasis on original sin and evil and all of that. And so there is already hostility towards freedom within our liberal tradition, and they can hijack that. What we have to do as liberals and people who really genuinely love freedom is to recognize that freedom is precarious, and that if we hope to keep our freedom, we have to use it wisely and we have to use it well. But in saying that, at the same time, I would say that to have a free society, you also have to have a society that is somewhat tolerant of a certain amount of vice. And if our society is totally intolerant of vice, if it sees virtue as something that is supreme and has to be imposed, if we're not tolerant of vice, we're not going to have a free society.
That's why I was struck when you said earlier on, Sharia Drury, that licentiousness troubled you about a freer democratic society. I would think that would be something to celebrate in a way.
Well, no, I'm too conservative for that. I mean, I think ultimately too much licentiousness and liberal society invites that kind of licentiousness, pornography and the like, and that fuels, I think, the madness of the right. It makes them wildly angry. And I don't think that that's a good idea.
So it may not be bad in and of itself, but it's bad because it is fueling these reactionary forces.
Partly that. I can't say that I would say all pornography should be shut down, but I think it should be kept hidden more so that it's not so accessible, not so in your face, not so offensive. So, I mean, a genuinely liberal society should allow people to raise their children the way they want to raise their children. And they can, and conservatives, I think, find themselves, they can't raise their children the way they want to in the face of the constant it's like a porn utopia that we're living in sometimes.
Do you see the influence of Strauss fading now, the influence of the neocons fading now with the disaster that the Iraq War was and is?
No, I don't see it fading. I mean, when George Bush is gone, he has all his cronies in place, and he's just been in a position to appoint a very young Supreme Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he's in a position to appoint yet another Supreme Court Justice. So I really don't think the influence of the neoconservatives is going to go away.
And in the Academy, is Leo Strauss still ascendant?
Well, in the Academy, I think there is a huge retreat, and many of the disciples of Leo Strauss are trying to disown him to some extent, or to claim that the people like Wolfowitz and people like Crystal are political Straussians that have nothing to do with Strauss. They've totally misunderstood him. Strauss meant the very opposite, which is really, really hard to believe. But they're trying to sort of exempt Strauss and say, really, he was not a political man. He just a guy who commented on ancient texts. That's just not true.
So they're trying to seal him, make him a mummy in a way.
Yeah.
And do you sometimes get assailed by his disciples? Are you in
No, not enough. I mean, I'd love to get more assailed by them.
Well, it's been delightful speaking with you today, Sharia Drury, political science, professor and philosopher at the University of Regina in Canada. Her two books on Strauss are The Political Ideas of Leo Strauss and Leo Strauss and the American Right. Shadia Drury, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.